I'm Liz Joyner. On behalf of the Village Square Board of Directors and their families, we'd like to welcome you to Immigration, the American Melting Pot. Tonight's program is made possible by the generous support of Ziffer Stansberry Advertising and Public Relations. It's our honor to have joining us this evening U.S. Ambassador to Portugal, Alan Katz. If you all didn't know already, the Village Square was Alan's harebrained scheme. And we actually make a rule out of the fact that if you fly all the way from Portugal to join us, you can talk.
Thank you very much, Liz. A couple of quick things, and first of all, to correct the record, this was actually Liz's idea, but she was smart enough to hornswoggle me into thinking that it was mine. So that all worked out very well. Let me just say a couple things. First of all, it's very nice to be back in Tallahassee, even if it is just a visit. It's nice to see the Village Square have another dinner on another important topic and a room full of people. Can I just ask the question I always ask whenever I happen to wind up at one of these things? How many of you are here for the first time to a Village Square event? Could you raise your hands? Thank you. You know, it's amazing. That seems to be the same percentage sort of every time, which is sort of gives us a lot of encouragement. I guess the only thing I want to say is about immigration, which is a topic that people seem to have strong feelings about, and being a first-generation American, of course, I have my feelings about it as well. But I'm currently the U.S. ambassador to Portugal, and Portugal in 1974, after they had their revolution and they granted independence to all of their colonies, a country of 9.5 million people absorbed 1 million immigrants in one year. And today in Portugal, the problems with immigrants is basically non-existent. They have many other problems, but that isn't one of them. So all I would sort of say to you is that having observed how you can bring a very large group of people into a country in a very short period of time, there are ways to deal with it. And hopefully whatever the process is that we wind up with in our country, we will find a way that makes us very proud to be Americans. Thank you all for coming. Liz, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Alan. Believe it or not, with all the jobs that Alan has to do internationally, he actually calls and checks up on us pretty often, don't you? Yeah, we appreciate it. Before we start tonight's panel discussion, I'd like to make another introduction to you. Mark Schlackman with FSU's Center for Advancement of Human Rights previously served as special counsel to Governor Lawton Chiles, where he was the governor's lead for a number of immigration-related issues. He was integrally involved in the governor's lawsuit against the federal government for failing to enforce U.S. immigration law, which was the first of its kind in the nation. He was later invited to remain on staff at the outset of Governor Jeb Bush's first term. We like that, very Village Square-ish. Then went on to serve in the Clinton White House for 2 years and later to act as special consultant for the Bush administration on immigration policy. Mark is going to say a word about the very unique and important role that our state of Florida has played in the immigration debate. Mark.
Thank you. Just a few minutes. Let's engage in some time travel. So remember where you started so you can get back off in the right place, okay? We're going back to summer of 1994. And at that time, in August of 1994, Governor Lawton Chiles was monitoring a situation that basically had tens of thousands of people in the water heading to Florida from Haiti and Cuba, 3,000 to 4,000 on any given day. His assessment was the federal government was not actually taking the steps necessary to mitigate the circumstances and enforce U.S. immigration law. He declared a state of emergency, and I was one of the staffers responsible for following through on that, declaring a state of emergency, traveling upon his authority within the Florida Constitution to protect the health and safety of the people of Florida and to try to prevent loss of life for those in the water. So what did that entail? Very, very briefly, because we don't have time to delve into this, and there are a few other issues I'll touch upon before I defer to Liz and Rabbi Romberg to take on the panel discussion. But essentially, one of the elements of this entailed deploying state and local law enforcement to establish a perimeter at Trumbo Point, which is Naval Air Station, state and local law enforcement to essentially establish a quarantine line against the federal government. What was at issue? Well, there were 30 years of enforcement of something also relatively unique to Florida, the Cuban Adjustment Act, which is a congressional act that was passed in the 60s. We know the history, so we'll skip through it as to the rationale, but it's still in force today. That act in law distinguishes or discriminates between Cubans and everyone else on the planet, and it becomes particularly vexing when comparisons are drawn to Haitians and their plight. But that is not de facto discrimination. That is purposeful distinguishing treatment. Okay. Amidst all of that, several months before, we're in 1994 now, this is August, a few months before Governor Childs filed the first of its kind lawsuit against the federal government for failure to adequately enforce U.S. immigration policy relating to costs within our school system, within our healthcare system, within the criminal justice, and filed that lawsuit. In preparation for filing that lawsuit, prepared a report which was released in March called The Unfair Burden, which was an attempt to quantify these costs and also to factor in the tax advantages wherein undocumented aliens, and that's a term of art, as you'll hear in the panel discussion, may have paid through. At the same time, later in this same year, we're still in 1994, by the way, as we move forward in October, President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was restored to Haiti by the U.S. military. Later in the year, in November, that was October 15, November in California, the people of California passed an initiative that was referred to as Prop 187, or the Save Our State Initiative. It was an extremely draconian initiative supported by then Governor Pete Wilson in California. And this is not intended to be partisan, it just provides context. Republican governor, and essentially that initiative would completely bar any services, public services, to undocumented aliens, whether it be public schooling, health, or otherwise. That was immediately stayed in court. Governor Childs opposed that initiative. We had early polling data in Florida that suggested there was an 82% approval rating for a similar initiative in Florida. We opposed that. What happened, and I'll give you the two-minute kind of overview. We decided that we could leverage these issues by way of collaborating with the federal government while we were trying to hold it accountable. Just as we were the first state to file a lawsuit for failure to adequately enforce U.S. immigration law, we were also the first state to sue on behalf of legal immigrants who were going to lose access to critical food stamps and other support lines during welfare reform. And these were elderly and infirm immigrants. So the tact that we decided, we absolutely had to take was one of balance, not to demonize people who may be fleeing their homes for a wide range of issues, but to focus upon the relationship between the federal and state government and the enforcement mechanisms, again, stopping short of demonizing those who are caught up in sometimes lives that we couldn't imagine. So it was balance. In 1996, we entered into a completely comprehensive, short of passing immigration reform on the Hill, a Florida immigration initiative, which was a collaborative effort with the federal government to do a wide range of things, to both promote lawful immigration as well as crack down on illegal. In 98, we passed the first of its kind agreement, entered into it with the federal government in terms of mass migration contingency planning. A wide range of issues, trying to step up to work with the federal government to the greatest extent possible. So To the extent that you can find it in your table, if you are interested, there are some documents, because we unfortunately just don't have time to go into Florida's rather remarkable history in terms of shaping the immigration debate on a national level. There's a op-ed on the front page. There are some press releases from the Department of Justice and a narrative from the Childs Foundation. So again, just a quick back-to-the-future perspective. These issues have been churning for many years. They can be obscure, never make the headlines, but they've been pulsating in states today. So as the more recently, the Arizona immigration law and all of the other states that have taken these issues on, there's still something that can be learned by looking back to the efforts that Florida undertook to try to overcome the fact that both Democratic and Republican administrations thus far have failed to pass comprehensive immigration reform. And perhaps the best way to close, and this really, as you can imagine, the Florida's approach toward these ends, again, to try to address the process concerns, led to a series of after-action follow-on reports with the Department of Defense, trying to learn where the geopolitical implications of this. But ironically, as undoubtedly we'll hear in the panel discussion, the George W. Bush Comprehensive Immigration Reform Initiative was substantially similar to what's being proposed by the Obama administration. Not identical, but substantially similar. So again, Liz, it's been a pleasure. This is the, I think, third time I've had the opportunity to speak. I think once was a night with the ambassador, the other was a post 9/11 retrospective, and it's a pleasure to be at Village Square. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Tonight's moderator, Rabbi Jack Romberg of Temple Israel, is a first-generation American. His parents both immigrated from Germany. His father left Nazi Germany age 16, so this is a topic close to his heart. Jack fulfilled his childhood dream of becoming a rabbi at age 42 after a career as a CEO of a furniture manufacturing company. He is very active in the civic life of Tallahassee, most famously, I might note, as the co-founder of the Village Square's Faith Food Friday program and a member of our God Squad. Jack.
Thank you. Thank you, Liz. So it was about 4 weeks ago that Liz called and asked if I would be willing to moderate the panel for tonight. And I said, gosh, I would be honored to do it, Liz. I'm just so honored to be asked. And then she came back with, and of course, you're welcome to a free meal. Well, Liz, what are you serving that night? Jambalaya. Well, Liz, doesn't jambalaya have pork in it? And you're asking a rabbi to moderate. Her response was, well, you'll have the vegetarian option. Well, then they changed the jambalaya to have turkey sausage, not because the rabbi was going to be here, but because Ambassador Katz was going to be here. So thank you, Alan, wherever you are. I have a question that I'd like to ask everyone before I call up our first panelist. I am a first-generation American, as Liz said. How many other first-generation Americans are here? How many can go back two generations? How many can trace the immigration of their family to the beginning of the 20th century? How about to the middle of the 19th century? Is there anybody who can trace back to the 18th century? Is there anybody who is connected to the landing of the Mayflower? I have news for all of you. We are all immigrants. It's with that in mind that I think we conduct tonight's discussion. There is no greater issue that provides a possibility for hope or disappointment, I think, right now, than the issue of what we do with our immigration policy. There is a new initiative on that just came out last week, and so my first panelist is Len Collins. Len Collins has just left Marco Rubio's office as being Senator Rubio's general counsel, legal counsel. He has been active in politics for quite a bit of time. I think that he now has just taken a position with Rod and Cassell in town, and I thought I saw Steve Turner walk in, who must have recruited him. And maybe most importantly is Len happens to be a friend of mine and commissioner of my fantasy baseball league. However, I invite Len to join us tonight.
Thank you so much.
So we now have legislation that came out last week in the middle of all of the hubbub over Boston, of course. Legislation was proposed by the Gang of Eight senators. Generally speaking, when I've read about the immigration issue, it breaks down into three general areas, so I want to take them one by one and ask you to comment on or just explain to the audience a little bit what are some of the details of how each is going to be handled. The three areas are generally border security, you know, in terms of who are we letting across, how are we monitoring the border. The second is what do we do with the backlog of undocumented immigrants that have come into the country? How do we handle them? How do we handle the different cases? Some of those cases are falling under a DREAM Act kind of policy, but most others are not. And then the third area is how do we reform our immigration policy so that we eliminate some of our concern for illegal or undocumented entries and get the workers that we need for immigration. So, Len, let's take them one by one. First of all, can you tell us how is this new bill addressing border security?
Good evening. The bill addresses border security in several different ways. First, we extend the fence. So the border fence has been partially built, partially not ready to go. This bill will finish the border fence. That's very significant. The bill will increase funding for Homeland Security to ensure that there are enough people with Homeland Security who can ensure that people crossing the border illegally are apprehended. The bill will track visa entry and exit. Currently, and it's so unusual in an age of computers, but currently we track people who enter the United States with a visa, but we don't track when or whether they leave. And one of the biggest problems, there's lots of talk about the border with Mexico, but about 40% of the problem that we have today with illegal immigration involves individuals who legally enter the United States and then overstay their visas and just don't return. We have no way today of tracking that. This bill will give us finally an opportunity, A, to track it, and B, to do something about it. And that's a very significant piece of this bill. In terms of securing the border, the biggest part of this from a Republican perspective is that until and unless the border is secure, none of the other provisions of the bill actually are in force. So until we know that the border is secure and that 90% of the people who attempt to cross the border are apprehended, until that's certified, all of the other things that we'll talk about do not take place. That was a very important piece for Senator Rubio. It's a very important piece for Republicans.
So Governor Bush wrote, I think, a very good book on potential immigration policy. And one of the things that he brings up in his book is that if we had an immigration system, a way that lets people into the country in a sane and logical manner that fills the needs of the country, that we actually decrease the pressure on border security. So, of course, the next piece of the puzzle is how do we reform that system? So what does this bill do in terms of reforming the immigration system?
In terms of reforming it going forward?
Yes.
Okay. The bill will provide an expansion of the H-1B visa. What that means is that if you happen to have skills, let's say you are a scientist or you're advanced in computer technology, and there are jobs for you in the United States, under today's law, there are only so many people who have those skills who are permitted to enter our country. Under the Gang of Eight bill, that number will double. And the expectation is that a tremendous number of new jobs will be created by increasing the number of H-1B visas that are available. That's a very, very important part of this. One of the reasons Senator Rubio wanted to get himself involved in this bill is because of concerns over the general state of our economy and where we stand with regard to the debt and deficit and how we as a country grow ourselves out of the tremendous debt that we face. How do you do that? And some folks believe you raise taxes. Other people believe you cut taxes. Another way to do it is to dynamically grow your economy. And there is a belief that if you reform immigration so that the right people are coming into the United States who have the skills to generate jobs, who have the capacity to do well, that the amount of job creation in our country will be so significant that it will begin to take, it'll make a major hit on our debt and our deficit. And so, that's a very important piece of this.
So keeping that thought in mind, how much will this bill expand the legal work opportunities for potential immigrants?
Well, it's very significant. It's significant. There are major corporations all across the United States that are very excited about the prospects of being able to bring people into the country who have the skills necessary to fill jobs that today are not being filled. And frankly, some of the jobs are going overseas to India, to China, where there are people who have the skills that are necessary to do these jobs. So to a degree, the free market will work in a way inside of our country in a way that will create a substantial number of jobs that will result in significant GDP growth. And that is, for everyone, a very substantial piece of this bill. And going forward is something that I think people on all sides should be encouraged about.
So a lot of this, of course, addresses the higher skilled, more educated worker, the one that clearly any country desperately, desperately wants. What is in this bill to address lower wage and lower scale jobs?
The bill provides for instance, migrant workers who come across our border. Some of them, frankly, are abused. Some are trafficked. This bill will allow folks who happen to be migrant workers to come out of the shadows and to legally come into the United States and to do to work. And then when their jobs most of this work is seasonal work, when the season's over, they'll have the capacity to go home knowing that they can return to the United States legally. That's a major piece of this bill.
So now let's look at the third component and take a few minutes for that before we bring up our next panelist to expand the conversation just a little bit. The next component is, how is this bill going to handle the backlog of people that are here classified by many as undocumented, by others as illegal? How is this bill going to handle them?
So for everyone who has been in the United States since 2011 and can document it, and that means that they'll have an electric bill or they'll have other records that indicate that they have been inside of the United States, they will have an opportunity to basically come forward. They will have to pay a fine. The fine is $2,000. They will pay taxes. There will be background checks. They will be fingerprinted. To the extent that these individuals have no prior arrest record, and some will, but to the extent that they have no criminal history, then they will be given a provisional status where they will be allowed to be in the United States legally, and they will be allowed to work. They won't be eligible for benefits. They won't be eligible for welfare benefits. They will have to, over the course of time, I believe it's 5 years into the 5 years after the time they register, they will have to again go through another background check. There will be another fine that's paid. They'll have to prove that they've paid taxes. But once all of these things have been qualified, after 10 years, these individuals would be able to begin the process where they could obtain green cards and ultimately become citizens. Individuals who happen to be legally online, this is a very important point, I know for Senator Rubio, the individuals who were online, who legally availed themselves of the process, will be processed before anyone who was illegally in the United States is processed and will have an opportunity to obtain rights and benefits that otherwise will not be available to folks who have illegally entered into the country. And so by no means, in our view, is this an amnesty, because you have individuals who are coming forward, who are paying a fine, who are paying taxes, who are not part of the system, and are frankly not obtaining benefits that individuals who legally avail themselves of the current process are obtaining. So if you legally were online, you will become a citizen faster than someone who is illegally in the United States.
There's a lot more to be said about each of these components. The bill is 800 and some pages, I believe?
845 pages long.
845 pages long. And I have not read all 845 pages. I have read a 17-page bullet point summary, which was also quite heavy reading. But before we expand our conversation a little bit, before I invite our next guest up, I know that Senator Rubio has played a very key role in this because of his visibility as an up-and-coming young star in the Republican Party. There are some people who say if you want to advance politically, don't try to actually get something done. Why is Senator Rubio going out on a limb?
Senator Rubio, when he was Speaker, used to invoke a phrase, you know, you can come to Tallahassee and be somebody or you can do something. And it's one or the other. And he went to Washington to do something. And the idea that you can play politics and get ahead, well, that catches up with you. He saw a significant need. This wasn't an easy decision for him in terms of getting involved in this particular issue. But he saw a need, and he saw, frankly, no one else leading on this, and frankly, a necessity to step up. And so he's done it. I'm proud of him. I think it's a great effort. And you know, the bill that's before us right now is, you know, it's going to go through the legislative process. So this isn't a final piece. This is basically a starting point. But it's good at least that the conversation has started. It's good that he's engaged, and it's good that the country has an opportunity to discuss these issues.
Our next guest who will join our panel is Antonio Giannata, who's from the Human Rights Watch. He is the Advocacy Director for U.S. Programs for the international organization Human Rights Watch. He formerly served as Executive Policy Advisor for Government Operations and Homeland Security for the Governor of Washington and Executive Director for Washington State Commission on Hispanic Affairs. Welcome, Antonio Giannata.
Thank you, Jack.
So now I expect our conversation to start to get perhaps a little bit more diverse and away from just a bullet talking point. What would you say your main concerns about the proposed legislation would be?
Thanks, Jack, and thanks for asking the question. First of all, if you allow me, I just want to say thanks to Village Square for inviting me to be part of this panel. It's been 17 years since I got my master's here at Florida State. It's nice to come back. Tallahassee has changed a lot in those last 17 years. I think if anybody was expecting fireworks tonight, I'm not sure I'm going to give them. I think in many ways this bill was a well-crafted, balanced bill. I will raise some concerns in this conversation, but I want to very much say right at the start that I commend Senator Rubio for his role in this process. Some very strong and prominent senators have tried to take on immigration reform in the past and have suffered politically from it. I mean, if you think back to August 2001 when the DREAM Act was first sponsored, that was not just a Durbin bill. That was a Dick Durbin and Orrin Hatch bill. But you don't hear about Senator Hatch's involvement much in immigration, or Saxby Chambliss, or Dick Lugar, or John McCain back and forth. It's been a tough political issue. But I think Senator Rubio has done an incredible job and a very eloquent job in defending this effort and doing the right thing. So I want to say that first off. Concerns. I could go to a number of different places. If you know Human Rights Watch, the work that we do, we're an independent international organization that reports on human rights abuses in over 90 different countries, and one of those countries is the United States. When it comes to immigration, every country has the right to regulate its borders and to decide who comes in and who comes out. But that ability to do so has to come into play with human rights obligations, due process, right to family unity. And if those things are not respected, then we're going to find a violation. We've been reporting on immigration issues for 20 years now. I mean, in the last few years, we've done reports on how persons with mental disabilities, immigrants with mental disabilities, are having difficulty navigating immigration court proceedings because they don't have counsel. We've been documenting the devastating impact of some harsh state immigrant laws. We did a report on the Alabama state immigrant law. Undocumented farmworker women and how they faced a vulnerability to sexual abuse due to their status. And through all of these reports, we tell stories and we develop recommendations, and those recommendations have been building and building and building with very little to come out of it. And so it's clearly time to actually try to tackle this issue once and for all. I'll tell a story. General facts. Under this bill, to legalize status, it's called registered provisional immigrant status. To get RPI status, you can't have in your background a felony, okay? Simple. So I'll tell the story of a young man who's in his 20s. He has two felonies. He's from Mexico, two felonies on his record. If I said that, a twice convicted felon, should they have any right to be in the United States? Many people would say no. But if you tell the story a little bit further and you say, Mario was brought here when he was 8 years old, if I'm not mistaken, and Mario did very well in school. He's undocumented, obviously. He did very well in school. He has never gotten in trouble with the law. He was working fine. Then all of a sudden, he got picked up in Arizona for some driving traffic offense. And in Arizona, what they're doing is if they see that you're working with false documentation, they'll charge you with identity theft. And identity theft is a felony. And with that felony, Mario was removed from the country. He was deported. One felony. Mario knows nobody else. He was deported to Mexico where he's got no family. All his family's in the United States. Mario tried to come back and he got picked up again. And he got charged now with illegal reentry, which is another felony. Two felonies. The question is the story of someone like Mario one that we want to consider when we're talking about some level of discretion in letting people in? Someone who has significant ties to the United States, families, has never gotten into any trouble with the law, except with an overzealous Arizona prosecution for identity theft, when really under the RPI provisions, the amnesty provisions, however you want to call them, there's a lot of people who are going to be benefiting who actually have used false documents. It's just part of the reality of living here for many years. I mean, you take the 11 million people who lived here, and two-thirds of them have lived here for over 10 years. There's a lot of equities to consider there, and that's one of the concerns.
Let me jump to another question, which will allow me to bring up our third panelist a little sooner than I anticipated. Not just yet, Sandy, but very soon. And that is, there seems to be a conflict of two particular areas where this person could fall under. One is the potential to be a registered provisional immigrant. That would be one. But could he, since he was also brought here as an 8-year-old, would he qualify under whatever is going to be in the DREAM Act?
My understanding is no, because of the conviction.
Because of the convictions.
Just for the record, the RPI component, we would appreciate not calling that the amnesty provision. No matter how you craft an immigration bill, there are going to be winners and losers. There's no way to do this where just everybody wins, especially within the immigrant population. Being convicted of a felony, whatever that felony is a significant strike. It has implications if you're an American citizen, if you're convicted of a felony, similar situation. You have all sorts of issues that carry on with you. In Florida, voting is quite difficult if you're a convicted felon. So, I mean, that's a major component of the bill.
No, understood, but clearly our argument is there are some family unity considerations to take into place, and there is discretionary language that could be available in the bill that would allow for these cases to come forward. Let me provide something else, since I know we'll talk about the DREAM Act a little bit later. you know, in January of 2012, you know, once the cutoff for the RPI status was over, there are children coming in right now. And there are children who would potentially qualify as Dream Act students but don't because of the cutoff line.
Right.
There's a way to craft a bill that is forward-facing and has some future discretion, because someone who qualifies for Dream Act in the past, the compassionate argument still exists for someone who came in January of 2012. Obviously, there's going to be a line drawn, but our argument is there needs to be a little bit more discretion in the bill to allow people like that still to have a chance to enter into the country in lawful status.
I think I do want to bring Sandy up here. I don't really know that Sandy Dallenberg needs an introduction to this community. He's been, of course, president of FSU. He's been a state representative. He's been dean of the law school. So it's my honor to invite Sandy to join us.
Jack, a person who just can't hold a job?
Well, you know, in Judaism, we actually give a lot of honor to those who are the sages of the community. So I think most people in this room would qualify you as one of our sages, Sandy.
Well, I hope people don't think I know an awful lot about immigration law.
No, but you do know a lot about a particular case,
yes,
which falls under the potential for DREAM Act provision. So I'd like you to talk to us a little bit about that case and give that story.
Good. And I've been posed on Mark Slackman to just pass around to each table a picture of a young man who came to the United States when he was 9 years old. He could not speak English. He enrolled in schools in Tampa. He came with his parents legally. They overstayed the visa, and by God, 9-year-old kid decided to stay with his parents. He went to high school, became valedictorian of his high school class in Tampa, became an Eagle Scout, went to New College in Sarasota, did extremely well, applied to FSU Law School after graduation. His admission essay said, is entitled something like, "How I Became a Criminal When I Was 9 Years Old." Of course, he did not become a criminal. It was not a criminal act. And he had stayed over. It's a civil violation, subject, I believe, to a pretty minor fine. He graduated from FSU College of Law with honors. I had him in several classes, a wonderful student. And then he decided to apply for the bar. The bar examiners required him to disclose what his immigration status was. And he disclosed that explicitly, as he had to the law school when he applied for admission to the law school. The bar examiners, on petition, allowed him to take the bar exam. He passed the bar exam. The Florida Board of Bar Examiners then did not admit him like it admitted other people after they'd complied with all the rules. Instead, they went to the Supreme Court of Florida and asked for an advisory opinion. The advisory opinion was, can we admit an undocumented immigrant to be a member of the bar? That was their question. Well, since that question was posed, it's now been briefed and argued in the Supreme Court. Last Friday, the court asked us to submit additional briefs. But since this case started, his status has changed. Under the Obama administration policy adopted June 15th last year, he was allowed as a DREAM Act kid to apply for deferred action. He's now an individual who has been granted deferred action and has been given a work authorization. And so his status now is he's done everything that the Florida bar rules require him to do. He's done everything to get work authorization, and he's still awaiting admission to the bar. And when I say I know nothing about immigration law, I know just enough to be able to take instructions from my law partner about how to handle the case.
A question that I have then for Antonio and Len is, we know what the executive order, I guess, if is that the correct term for what the president did last June? But is there any movement to get this into some sort of formal legislation or to move this as part of the bill that the eight senators have proposed?
Let me say one good... Yes, on both. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program is actually it's recognized inside the bill, and DREAM Act is a key component of that bill. There's also really great language, at least for DREAM Act kids who don't have the felony issue that I raised. There's some eligibility for DREAM Act eligible students who were removed to reapply as DREAMers and come back into the country. That was something I was not expecting. I was really pleased with in the bill.
Anything to add, Len?
There are reasons why the bill came together in the way it did. And I know in the case of the student you're talking about, he would certainly be covered under the bill. There's no cutoff. And there was talk of there being a cutoff. Ultimately, I believe Republicans are comfortable, or hopefully are comfortable with the bill, based upon what happens in the future. And to a degree, you have a bill that looks back, looks at the present, and looks at the future. And in terms of the future, there were huge concessions from unions, and there are big things that this bill will do going forward. But yeah, it's true that children in these circumstances, even if they have been deported from the United States, under the bill would be able to under certain circumstances return.
And as I understand the bill, I think it allows an early path to citizenship for these people who fall in this category.
That's correct. That the children who would fit within the DREAM Act provisions, I believe, would wait about 5 years before they would be able to be eligible for citizenship. And so that's truncated. That's perhaps 10 to 15 years less of a wait time for citizenship than everyone else.
I think what I'd like to do is use a little bit of moderator's discretion and say that if there are any questions from the... I keep wanting to say congregation. any questions from the audience, we'll slip a few in, but I reserve the right to go back to the panel at any time because I have some other things I want to cover. But I want to open up the conversation a little bit from the floor if anybody
okay.
is.
And I'm going to say a word about that. We'll have two people roaming the audience for questions. If you want to just get our attention, we also have question sheets on the tables that if you'd rather us ask the question for you, you can fill those out and just hold it up. I'm going to go ahead and start with a question now. This morning I heard a news show discuss how 9/11 quashed a joint effort by President Bush and President Fox of Mexico to implement a major immigration reform initiative and raise the question of how the recent events in Boston might impact current discourse and potential immigration reform. So the question is, how do you think Boston is going to or has already impacted the debate?
I'm happy to take the first shot at it. Back to the DREAM Act, 2001 was the first time it was introduced, August of 2001. When I was advising the governor of the state of Washington, Governor Locke, in 2002, there were already efforts to talk about how to cut undocumented pregnant women, how to cut their medical care. Even though they were going to give birth to a U.S. citizen child, most likely, there were talks about how to get there. The conversation about immigration enforcement has just slowly metastasized over time without any kind of relief. I mean, one of the first op-eds I wrote at Human Rights Watch was the Alabama proposal that would have required checking immigration status of kids who were trying to get into extracurricular activities. So they're like, once you walk into the prom, they were going to check your papers. I mean, it's been that troubling, the whole process. It's been very little action. So This is a debate that's been going on for a very long time, and I do not believe is going to get derailed by this one attack. I also want to say this. It isn't just 11 million undocumented people. There's a million U.S. citizens who are married to to people without status, who are could be separated from their wives or reunited with their spouses due to this bill. There are 5 million U.S. citizen children who have undocumented parents in the country could be benefited by this bill. That's 17 million. That's almost 5% of the U.S. population. This is too big of an issue to be derailed by this one attack.
With regard to what happened in Boston, I think there are very significant questions in terms of what our government knew. Apparently, the Russian government contacted the United States government to indicate that at least one of these individuals was involved in what they suspected to be terrorist activities. What we knew, what was done, how things worked, I think that there are legitimate questions with regard to what happened in Boston and what our government did with regard to determining whether or not a legitimate threat existed that need to be answered. I don't believe it derails the bill, but frankly, I think that where the bill is at this point is in its very early formative stages, and to the extent that there are things that can be learned from Boston that could be incorporated into the bill, I think probably they should be and they likely will be.
I actually want to take that question and your responses and recast in a little bit different way, and I am going to be picking on both of you guys because both of you have spent some significant time in Washington, and that is the real question behind that question is, how strong is the political will? Are there enough congressmen and senators of courage to actually say, let's stop messing around and get something done? Because some of what you've seen in the last day or so coming out of the debate in Washington is one senator saying, well, maybe we should reconsider with some things, and then another one saying, oh, you're just trying to politicize, which then just spirals down a path that is completely not useful.
Let me say something that maybe Len can't say. If Senator Grassley, Chuck Grassley, looked out the window and saw that it was cloudy, he'd have enough of a reason to try to block this bill. He's looking for opportunities, and it's disingenuous to link it to this. And the opponents of this of immigration reform are being unfortunately opportunistic with this tragedy.
Well, that speaks to the deeper point, which is if the opponents are that deep-seated, then do we have any hope to get something through?
Look, there are always people who are opportunistic in politics. It's politics. I mean, the idea that Senator Grassley's up in arms, well, Senator Grassley's typically up in arms. And that's sort of his preset. I like Senator Grassley a lot. I don't mean to in any way denigrate Senator Grassley, but that's his preset. That being said, the question now is not whether or not, you know, you support this bill or, you know, there has to be an alternative. I mean, this isn't an all or nothing take. Well, to the extent that this bill isn't the vehicle, okay, then what is? And if the idea is that we continue to do nothing, well, isn't that worse? And in my view, it is. And to the extent that there's any political pressure that exists, you know, there certainly is some political pressure, I think, both on the left and the right. But the reality is you have a bill in its formative stages. And if folks have other ideas, bring them forward. We want to hear your ideas. I know Senator Rubio has insisted, and let me just say this. The Senate is an arcane place where there are, frankly, there are no rules, which makes no sense. But truly, it's the Wild West with regard to how bills are considered. There are no rules. And typically the rules happen because of what's called a unanimous consent request. But typically, unless something forces a bill to move forward, nothing happens, which is the preset of the Senate. Very little happens there. And to the extent that something isn't done, well, then one more time, nothing will happen. But there is a legitimate move at this point, I think, from folks on the right, and it's more than just Senator Rubio, who recognize that doing nothing is de facto amnesty, that allowing people to be in the shadows and not be documented is more harmful to our country and violates our own values than anything. And so if this bill isn't the answer, fine. What's your answer? What's your plan?
and bring it, you know, hopefully folks will bring it forward. We insisted on process. And so there have been, I know there have been at least 2 days worth of hearings, but there are going to be many more. You know, there likely will be an open amendment process. In the Senate, again, no rules. So you can have an amendment on travel to space and tag it onto an immigration bill. It can be about anything. And those amendments all should be heard in regular order, and the process itself should work. And if it does, then we're going to have a vehicle that will address all of the issues that we're talking about.
I know Liz has some more questions from the floor.
Hi. My name is Juan Escalante, and I'm a recent graduate from Florida State University. I'm also an undocumented immigrant residing here in the United States. I have been granted deferred action under the newly enacted Obama policy, and while Congress continues to debate this immigration bill, people in my community, in the undocumented community, continue to be deported and denied access to higher education. Individuals like myself and Jose often depend on scholarships or in odd-end jobs to pay for our tuition. Recently, Florida International University enacted a policy that would allow individuals to waive out-of-state tuition and pay pay in-state tuition. Do you think that is something that can aid the movement of this bill and provide relief for some of the people residing within the state? And how possible is it that other institutions, such as Florida State, can enact a policy like that so that I can continue my education?
That's why we have panelists.
I feel uncomfortable. I just don't know that I can speak for Florida State. I would just say this. I think the idea of in-state tuition has been a very laudable idea. When I was working at the Commission on Hispanic Affairs in Washington State 13 years ago, I was meeting people who were DREAM Act eligible 12 years ago, back then. And what happened? Because they didn't get in-state tuition on Washington State, luckily they did, but in other states, for those 12 years, while they were, while they could have been building up and going to college and getting ready to legalize their status and contribute to the community, those avenues were blocked. And so I think that in-state tuition is a very smart idea, and I think colleges should take it up, states as well.
Yeah. Jack, as you begin to look at federal law, there's a federal law that purports to bar public benefits from anyone who is undocumented, or even people today who have authorization to be in the United States and have a work permit. And the federal law purports to say that the states and local government may not give any public benefits, including licenses, to people who were formerly talked about as undocumented immigrants. I think now, with a change in status, we really now have a group of people who were undocumented immigrants and are now in this country with federal approval, and they have work authorization. Now, I learned only today that Florida licensing agencies that operate through the Florida Department of Business and Professional Regulation do not deny licenses to people who are in that status and you've got a driver's license, he's holding up, and you may have other types of professional and business licensing. So Florida has been pretty forward-looking in some respects, but not in terms of tuition yet. There's been legislation proposed, not yet passed, in the Florida legislature. What we ought to do is completely repeal that public benefits law. And I won't ramble on, but there are a lot of dumb federal laws. But this one ought to be in the running for one of the most stupid things we do.
Well, Sandy, you know, you raise what I think is another good question that we should throw out back to Antonio and to Len, which is here you have a federal statute that interferes with the potential for the state to enact something or to take an action. So my question, and here's where I wish we had Senator Flores, because my question really is what parts of this should be left to the states? Where should the states be exercising more control? What should the federal government be farming out to the states, and what should the states be drawing back from doing?
That is it's very difficult because every state ultimately can involve itself in this issue in different ways. And so I know that there are certain states. I know Texas, for instance, has in-state tuition for children that would qualify under the DREAM Act.
Let me give an example, which is right out of Governor Bush's book. In the bill that's proposed, nobody who is on the provisional status, in other words, it's from our backlog of undocumented immigrants, would receive welfare benefits, okay, would receive Medicaid. Okay. Governor Bush, in his book, points out perhaps that's a decision best left to the state level. Maybe there are states who would, for whatever reasons, want to grant those benefits, in particular in something like tuition, in-state tuition or some kind of reduced tuition. And should that not be something left to state decision making?
I think, again, with any bill, you have provisions in a bill that are there in order to garner support. And I think in this bill in particular, you have a whole set of concessions that were made on the right, and that this particular issue is a concession to people on the right in order to make this work. And so to the extent that you pull at that provision, then you lose all of the other provisions that are that I think folks on the left would look at as positive. And so it's tough because you have you actually now have legislation. So it's outside of the realm of pick this versus take that. This is the policy choice.
So what you're saying is it's very appropriate we served sausage tonight because this is nothing but sausage making.
Well, I'll be more generous. This is a very delicately balanced bill, and I do agree. And I think when you hear legislators, particularly in the House, saying what we want to do is we want to take this apart and take border security first and then do interior enforcement and then look at legalization separately, all they're trying to do is kill this effort because there's a very key balance that's been built here in the Senate bill, and taking it apart in that way risks that balance.
The other point is, and I know our office went through this calculus. The initial thought was, well, what we want to do is we want to take individual pieces of this legislation and do, for instance, do border security first. Right. So if you were to do the border security piece of this bill first, so you secure the border, that's great. Everybody, I think everybody's at least in favor of securing the border. But then you're going to do E-Verify. And so everyone who is that's a major component of border security. Fine. So if you're doing E-Verify, you have someone who happens to be undocumented who's working under the current law. Now they're exposed under E-Verify. They can't work anymore. You're going to have a humanitarian crisis because you're going to have 10 million people in the United States now who cannot work under any circumstances, at least not legally. And that's not the current state of affairs today. And so if you were to do the border security piece first, then you would be scrambling on the backside to handle basically what is another component of the bill, which is how you address individuals who are currently in the United States. So this is, as I see it, one of the only ways to do this. There are other possible ideas, but in terms of format, in terms of how you consider this entire issue, I don't know that you can consider it successfully in not a comprehensive manner.
Liz.
This is for anyone, a comment from the audience, from someone who's lived a long time overseas. We seem to start from the assumption that a porous border is undesirable, yet UK, France, Germany, all large economies and culturally diverse, and most smaller, more homogenous European countries are far more porous, and this does not seem to affect their economies. Please comment.
Gesundheit.
I want to just at least challenge one of the assumptions. It's Germany, for example, has struggled with their immigration law. And I think in some of this discussion, there's been a recent relaxing of their immigration provisions. But there was a key part of this discussion where people were proposing the idea of a status that never reaches citizenship, sort of a permanent temporariness that people have seen take place in places like Germany. And appropriately, I think that was pushed aside. But I don't feel like I'm enough of an expert in all other parts of European immigration to comment intelligently about it.
I do think there's a significant difference, and that is that in Europe, France and Germany, basically their economies are developed to the point that if you happen to live in France and go to Germany, well, you're going to go back to France. I mean, there are jobs in France, there are things in France, and if you speak French, it makes sense. You're going to stay in your home country. Where what we have on our southern border is, and to a degree, it's not really addressed by the bill, but factually, Mexico is suffering, and the Mexican economy is in terrible shape. There's a tremendous amount of corruption and drug running in Mexico, and frankly, not just in Mexico, but throughout Central America, and that plays a factor in what comes across the border and some of the drug wars that have been prevalent in the last 10 years on the Mexican border. And that's just something you don't see at all in Europe. And so it's not really an apples to apples comparison.
Over here.
Sure. I'm Kristen Hagen. I work at Florida State University and the Center for Global Engagement. And I wanted to bring it back to the legal immigration aspects of the law. Often that gets set aside because border security obviously is something that is really controversial, dealing with undocumented because of the number of people here. But there are a lot of really positive things that the bill could do, as Mr. Collins was saying, to bring talented, skilled workers to the U.S. Many of those are already in the United States, in Florida, and in Tallahassee. Our professional association, NAFSA, has done some economic analysis, and they've said, for example, in the state of Florida, international students and their families contribute over $900 million to our economy. International education is an export. Here in Tallahassee alone, they estimate over $50 million generated through tuition, living expenses. They even deduct the amount given in scholarships, tuition waivers, things. So these are people already in the U.S. getting PhDs. I mean, I know 3/4 of our students are graduate students, and many of them will stay here and contribute. But the way our immigration system is set up right now, it's very difficult and very time-consuming for these highly skilled workers to contribute. So there are positive things in this bill that can alleviate backlogs. You're talking about backlogs for undocumented and family, but there's also skilled workers, particularly from China and India, who are having to wait over 5 years, over 8 years, even after employers like FSU have done everything to jump through the hoops. We've gotten everything approved, but there are many years of waiting. So this bill, if it's passed, would do a lot of things to help the legal immigrants who always get frustrated because you hear border security and you hear undocumented and that you can't get to the legal until it's going to be later, done. I also would say that, like Mr. Giannata said, there are a lot of stories, too. Harold Croteau, Nobel Prize winner, he came to FSU through immigration. So we've got lots of good stories, lots of positive immigration, and the bill would, I hope, the other things can be dealt with so that all the positive legal immigration can come through, too.
I think this is an opportunity for me to maybe put a different, kind of a different spin or a different, I want everybody to think about this a little bit differently than we've been, in the path that we've been going on so far. And that is, we've talked a lot about the economic benefits of immigration. We've talked a lot about how that's an engine that supplies talent at all levels, on the PhD level, on the engineering skill level, on the skilled worker level, and everybody agrees that that's a wonderful engine. But the component that's going to be changed, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, is the family preference category. It's going to reduce from siblings, adult siblings being allowed to come in, to just spouses and minor children, which means that we are changing the very tenor of our immigration system. So my question, not just for those of us sitting up here, but for everybody listening, is do we understand that this change is about to happen?
The one thing I think that's important, one important piece of that, is that once the bill passes, the bill has, I believe it's a year and a half window. So that if you do have family members, if you happen to be a relatively recent legal immigrant, you have family members who are abroad, if they were to apply within the year and a half window post-passage of the bill, then they too would be, there'd be a very long backlog, but your family member would be able to, once the backlog is processed, ultimately the door won't be closed for a year and a half. So long as you file within that time period, your family member would be eligible to come into the United States. So it's not as radical of a change as it may sound, at least for people who are here now.
One of the good things in the bill is it makes spouses of lawful permanent residents immediate relatives, so it makes it quicker for them to come in. But I agree. I think the idea of cutting out siblings, I feel like that was just a negotiating tactic. It was very clear it was going to go. There was a lot of there are folks who are in the anti immigration reform category have always opposed the sibling visa, and sometimes your sibling could be your closest relative. So I don't necessarily think that was the right idea.
Question, Liz.
Hi, I'm Gwen Keenan. I'm a retired Coast Guard officer and currently employed for the state. I had a question. I think it'll directly go to Mr. Collins. Does this law take into account, after having served 20 years as an enforcement officer of immigration law, does this law level the playing field on the enforcement side to eliminate some of the elements of our immigration law, and speaking specifically to the Cuban Adjustment Act, that create a draw for illegal immigration because of inequities? And does it level the playing field, or how does it impact enforcement?
It doesn't address, specifically to the Cuban Adjustment Act, it doesn't address it. Although there may be other vehicles where that may well be addressed in the future. In terms of leveling the playing field, I'm not sure that current immigration, perhaps you're talking about the Haiti-Cuba issue. Is that where you're going?
Or,
well, in terms of... In terms of interdiction, the bill spends a substantial amount of money. I believe it's $5 billion in increased funding to Homeland Security, to increase enforcement, and that's not just at the border. That's also at the airports and seaports to address who is coming into the country and to address to provide enforcement with the capacity to enforce our laws, which to a great degree has not happened.
Liz?
This one's fun. This question is for Rabbi Romberg.
Uh-oh. I'm not an expert on anything.
No, on this you are. What light does your faith tradition shed on this issue? What does Scripture say about sojourners at the gate? In the gate, excuse me.
I think that the Torah says 36 times, which is a significant Jewish number, about how we should treat the stranger that lives among us, which is to be just as if they were a citizen. So the Torah is very clear that you treat the stranger that lives among you just as you do the fellow Israelite. I love the chance to be able to bring out some of my Jewish background, but I don't know how relevant that becomes to this discussion. But I will tell you something that is relevant. I want to read something to everybody. I think it's time to inject a little more emotion. From Emma Lazarus. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Those are the words on the Statue of Liberty. My dad passed underneath those words, as did my mom. And I really wonder, with all this talk about rationalizing why we need to economically change immigration, are we losing sight of the human factor? Are we the country we really want to be? I ask you that. I ask you that, the people who are listening. And how is the path we're going on really taking us to the country we want to be? Are those words just a nice piece of poetry on a statue in New York Harbor? Or do they really mean something to this country? I'm asking you folks that.
Jack, may I have a shot at that?
Absolutely.
Jack's sermon.
The shortest one I ever gave.
Was absolutely on point. And I want you to think a little bit about principles that govern equal protection in the United States. And repeatedly, the United States Supreme Court has said that treating aliens in a discriminatory way violates equal protection. We have a large number of cases directly on that point. And it's a point that's quite consistent with Jack's sermon, and I think quite consistent with the sentiments expressed in the poetry on the Statue of Liberty. And some of our approaches to the immigration problem ignore the fact that we have very good constitutional principles that, if put in play, would address this problem in a way that's moral.
And I actually would like to say to Len that I read in Senator Rubio's support for this a bit of his support for this ideal. I do, because from his background, he can't help but feel that way, I would think.
Well, I think immigration and welcoming people into the United States, people who come to the United States, coming here is not an easy thing. Leaving your home country, where you're from, your family, your roots, and getting up, picking up one day and leaving. Think about that. I mean, that's a hard thing. And people who do that, I can just speak to my relatives who came to the United States. You know, they're go-getters. And Senator Rubio talks about that often in his speeches, about people who came to the United States, who his family, you know, his parents, his came here with nothing and built their life. And to a great degree, people like that, immigrants, carry with them the American dream and sort of are a mirror into who we are. And that's a good thing. Now, you know, irrespective of this bill, 1 million people a year are legally become citizens of the United States every year. But certainly, legal immigration is one of our best traditions. It's who we are as a people. It's something that, when done right, is a great thing, and it's a credit to our country, and it's what makes us an exceptional country.
Can I just say something, just very quickly, on this sort of traditional model of what we envision of the immigrant coming upon the tempest-tossed shores? Because there's been such an action over these last 20 years, you're seeing people who are being deported after living here 15, 20 years, and they have built roots in the United States. They're not coming to a new country. They're coming back to their country. And we have to recognize that, and hopefully with this reform, we'll be able to address some of the conflicts that are coming from that.
Liz.
So in preparation for this program, I read Governor Bush's book. And frankly, it just felt tragic. It felt tragic because there is so much agreement, and so much of this seems like a no-brainer. I would go so far as to say that I think if the four of you all got together and worked on this, you'd come up with a reasonable immigration reform plan. Why can't we? What's keeping us from getting there?
Well, the Senate's not. The Senate's a really interesting.
The Senate's not
place,
made up of reasonable
Senate,
people.
No. The senators from different states have different interests, different motivations, and depending on who you are and where you're from, you may feel differently about these issues. And that's not to denigrate folks who feel that way. I mean, those are legitimate concerns that individual members have raised. And frankly, it's not just the Senate. Look, I would expect that a bill in some form close to this will pass the United States Senate. You never know, but my expectation is that ultimately something will pass the Senate. The question is what happens in the House. And there are like-minded people in the House who have legitimate concerns. And those concerns need to be addressed. And hopefully the process is open and allows people the capacity to participate in the process, because the first objection, which may well be legitimate, is I didn't have an opportunity to participate, so I have to vote against the bill. So the idea is to open the process, allow as many members to provide their ideas and amend the bill and build out something that people can support. But this is an incredibly difficult bill. It may be the most difficult bill to come through. I know, look, Republicans, I don't want to go into a partisan moment, but Obamacare was an incredibly difficult bill too. And bills like this are basically once-in-a-generation type bills. They're hard. We went through like the litany of other senators who attempted to go down this course and had their careers tarnished to some degree or another. This is hard. And as much as folks can agree on it, there are many people who have, in my view, legitimate concerns with regard to this. Other folks who have concerns that may be less so. But this is something that requires everyone to be involved in and all voices to be heard. And my hope is that people will recognize the fact that doing nothing is far worse than the proposals that have been extended thus far. And hopefully enough voices come out against doing nothing that something can happen.
Liz, you have another question?
Hi, my name is Fabrice. I'm a graduating senior at Florida State. My question was addressed to Mr. Collins over there. We have discussed that the border must be secured before the provisions of the bill takes effect. So my question was, who decides the border is secure? Who decides that the border is secure? And is there a commission or is it a federal government?
I believe there is a federal, the federal government ultimately, there are metrics that have to be achieved. And if the metrics are not achieved, then ultimately there would be a commission made up of governors of border states that would ultimately certify that the border, in fact, is secure. But when you look at the amount of money that we're talking about spending, when you look at the plans that have been extended, and frankly, when you look at what's going on even today, because you don't see mass migration across the U.S.-Mexican border at the moment, these goals are achievable. And my full expectation is that these goals, especially given the plans that have been set forth, these goals I would expect will be achieved and certified as such. But, if they're not, then the bill won't. Then the provisions of the bill that cover individuals who are currently illegally in the United States in terms of green the capacity to obtain a green card, those provisions will not go into effect until this certification occurs first. And it's important that people know that the border is secure, that the government is doing its part with regard to making sure that the border is secure, and that we don't find ourselves in this position in 20 years. And that's a major component of it.
I think that there are metrics that are on the link that I sent to you, Liz. So if that link is up on the Village Square website, then people could be free to go and look at the metrics that are in the bill.
I'll put it up when I get home tonight on the blog if you'd like to look at it. Specifically on that point, following up, Len, is there anything in the bill to ensure that securing border will not be used as an excuse to delay applying the rest of the bill? Is there any danger that the process of securing the border is going to simply take too long on purpose?
Well, there are always legit, unfortunately, there are people on all sides who will not trust people on the other side. And I understand where the question's coming from. I believe that that certainly that the members of this quote-unquote gang of eight have come to a position where they're comfortable with this. And I can't fathom the members of either side acting in bad faith. And so this is a proposal that's come up in good faith, and my full expectation is that to the extent that the metrics that are laid out are not met, that the provisions in terms of providing green cards, will be delayed, but ultimately that this bill will that those provisions will be met. And I think that's a reasonable expectation that those provisions will be met.
We have a question from over here.
I wanted to ask a question about provisions for migrant farm labor. Different states around the country really depend on this form of labor to harvest crops from Florida all the way through California. How will this legislation impact that? Will there be some provision for work visas and some kind of consideration for those laborers?
Yeah, with regard to migrant workers, there are specific provisions within the bill that will allow migrant workers to come into the United States. They would have to establish that there's a need for them, but that's, again, something that's relatively straightforward. And then they would be able to work inside the United States, and then when seasons are over, then they would be able to go home, which is great, because unfortunately with migrant workers, you see a substantial amount of human trafficking. You see a substantial amount of individuals who are exploited, who happen to be, you know, really the most poor and vulnerable in society. And you know, some of these folks are working for nothing and are basically afraid to go to authorities, because if they go to authorities, they can be deported or they could get arrested. And so one of the great things about this bill is it brings people like that, you know, it shines light on them, and they're able to legally provide services that are needed inside the United States that other folks won't do. And it resolves that issue, and those people will live much better lives as a consequence of this bill if it's passed.
Question over here.
Oh, okay. The question earlier about European porous borders was mine, and I just wanted to reply particularly to Mr. Collins' comments. And in doing so, I'd like to keep in mind both the remarks that were just made about securing the border before this act will come into effect, and also, please, the rabbi's quotes about the Statue of Liberty. Mr. Collins, with all due respect, your comments either show an immense naivete about immigration in Europe, or they show perhaps some glibness, I'm not sure, and I'm being warned about being civil. I apologize.
I just dinged her a little.
She just dinged me a little. Immigration in Europe is not French going into Germany or vice versa. Immigration in Europe is many, many less developed countries flowing into Europe. It is North Africans flowing into Italy and France. It is Turkish and those of Middle East descent flowing into Germany. It's Eastern Europeans, Indians, Pakistanis, and Southeast Asians flowing into the UK. I lived there for 12 years. There are very, very large numbers. These countries absorb them, and their economies did nothing but fly until the meltdown that was recently caused to great degree by deregulated, toxic U.S. securities. So I'll stop there. I don't so much have a question as I ask you simply to
well, but let me address. I mean, look at the laws in Germany with regard to how they treat people who aren't German. If you're Turkish and you go to Germany and live there and work there, you can never become a citizen of Germany. Never. There are multiple generations of people who were born in Germany, who speak German, who are part of Germany, work there. They're not citizens of Germany. And so to compare, that's my understanding. Am I misstating it? But
I know naturalized Germans. I'm sorry, it's not true.
maybe we can do a little fact checking on it later, and we'll put it up. How about that?
That was my understanding. At least if it's not current law, it certainly was the law. In terms of, look, every country has the opportunity and the obligation to enforce its immigration laws. And, you know, different people can disagree, and there are different ways you can look at the world. I'm certainly not an expert on European immigration. And so I attempted to answer the question as best as I could.
Yeah, no, let's be aspirational, though. Let's look into the real future. If you drive from Seattle to Vancouver, BC, you pass the Peace Arch. It's a beautiful crossing. There's a statute. It says, children of a common mother, I think is describing the relationship between U.S. and Canada. It's an incredible crossing. I mean, in terms of just, it's visually beautiful. And then you go to Nogales, and then you see that fence, and you see that wall. And an immigration policy that is just supporting the idea that you can just block off Mexico and create this jagged scar between these two countries. Let's hope that at some point with some investment into and Mexican into the Mexican economy, that the border is less hostile than it is, and that there not, aren't people dying in crossing that border. We can be aspirational.
You know, there is a country that in about a six-year period of time absorbed enough immigrants that it doubled their population at a point where they were actually rather poor. That country is Israel, that took in about 800,000 Jewish refugees in the span of about 6 years, literally doubling their population in the early years of the state. They found a way to do it because it was necessary for them to do it. We have to, I think, understand that not enough people in this country feel it's necessary, and so we have to take the steps that are probably put forward in the 8th Senator's bill, because that at least gets us out of the logjam that we're in. A question over here.
So this was a question. Is there anything in the bill that addresses the conditions of persons who are imprisoned for a civil immigration offense to reduce mandatory detention?
Yes. So the bill actually has very specific and good language that says that even if a person is required to be kept under very strict mandatory detention laws, which is another long conversation, the secretary can create alternatives, secure alternative, it's called, something like an ankle bracelet or some other form of monitoring that could be considered custody but keeps people out of what we consider actual detention.
You had another one over here?
I am not sure if this is just like ignorance of the law or not, but you were talking about like the fines and stuff that after 5 years and then maybe 10 years, they have to pay $2,000 or X amount of dollars. With a lot of these people that are coming into the country and having to live five people in a home and whatever else to be able to sustain the money or to be able to utilize all that money to keep them here, how is the idea in the bill that they're going to even be able to pay these fines to become U.S. citizens?
There is some capacity to waive under certain circumstances, but there's an expectation that folks who want to avail themselves of this process and move forward and get a green card are going to be able to have the money to do this. To the extent that they do not pay the fine, then they will remain in this provisionary status until they do pay the fine. And that, to some degree, you're going to see people who, yes, they're going to be people who matriculate through the process and get green cards and ultimately become citizens. But you are also going to see some folks who begin the process, are legally allowed to be in the United States, but for whatever reason aren't deportable, but don't move through the process, don't obtain a green card. And you will see folks who are in that temporary status and it'll extend, and that the process doesn't force people to leave that status. And so that's possible, too.
Quick. Liz, you have a question from back there?
My name is Janito Simon, a recent law school graduate. I believe one of the facts that makes a country sovereign, and I believe you gentlemen talked about it, is allowing individuals in and not allowing individuals in a sovereign nation. But my question is, considering American history, specifically Latin American policy in the past, which may have caused the unstable nature of those countries today, is there a moral obligation for America to deal with immigration fairly?
Who wants to talk about morality? Well, don't ask me, because I, of course, would say yes, but that's what you would expect. Sandy.
Jack, let me ask a question. It is George Will's question. Are we as a nation, do we have the will to deal with this issue? And specifically, do we have the will to expel 11 million people? And George Will says, if you wanted to send all the people who are here from Mexico, who are here without documentation, you're going to have to put buses bumper to bumper from San Diego to Alaska and drive those buses to Mexico. There isn't a soul here who would put up with that. And the moral question to me is, would we permit that? And if not, are we going to do something as an alternative to that?
Over here.
Oh, I can sit. Yay. So my question, I don't really know the bill that well, I'll be honest. And then also, so if it's not in the bill, what would be a way to go forward? I'm a victim advocate, so I work a lot with people that have been sexual abused and things of that nature. And undocumented people that live in America, and oftentimes children, can be the victims of abuse like this. Mm-hmm. So what would be part of the bill or a way moving forward to encourage them to speak up when, in the first place, they're nervous to speak to anyone that's an authority figure that could help them? So what kind of agencies or education could take place to encourage children and other victims of sexual assault to come forward to discuss?
There are specific visas that are called T visas that exist for illegal, and that's the law today. You don't need to pass a law. The current law has, I believe there are 15,000 T visas that individuals who are sexually assaulted can avail themselves of. They would need to go to the authorities, turn themselves in, and participate in the prosecution of the individual who abused them, which is difficult. If you're a victim's advocate, you know that that's not the easiest thing in the world. But ultimately, if you are a victim of sexual assault in the United States, you can avail yourself of a T visa and can remain.
If I can just add, it's also the U visa. It used to be 10,000. This actually adds another 8,000 per year. Another 5,000, particularly to people who could be victims of crimes like the ones you're talking about, another 3,000 for people who are victims of serious workplace violations and exploitation in the workplace. So there is some, and there's a liberalization to the rule as to qualifying for the U visa. So there's some good language in there on that. You should check it out.
We have time for one more question, then we'll wrap it up.
Okay. Mr. Collins, you've explained the 10-year horizon for citizenship. What is the status of children to such people born in the United States during those 10 years?
Well, first of all, if it's 10 years to a green card, and then you'd have to go through the green card process. So it's more than 10 years in terms of to get to citizenship. But for children that are born in the United States under the Constitution, anyone who is born in the United States is an American citizen. And so to the extent that a child is born in the United States to two parents who happen to be illegal, that doesn't impact their status. They are still legal citizens of the United States upon birth.
Well, we've spent a bit of time trying to analyze some proposed legislation. We, of course, have considered some of the moral implications. And we've done the requisite beating up on some politicians, too. But really, the question lies in your hands, meaning those of us who are citizens of this country, because honestly, Senator Rubio can't do anything unless we make it clear that we support him, that he is actually then representing our interests by his putting forth this bill with seven other senators. And so it really is incumbent upon us, if you believe that this problem can be solved and should be solved, and that this is a positive step forward, then it is up to you, each one of you, to make your voices heard. Nothing gets solved unless the will of the citizens is known. So I suggest we not cry to ourselves about how Washington is stuck, and that we let our representatives know what it is we expect. Thank everybody for coming, and I hope you all enjoyed.